Welcome to So Ordered, where we create audio readings of SCOTUS decisions to make them more accessible to the public. At the time of creating this podcast, the Supreme Court of the United States does not release audio of the court's decisions. Our mission is to make it so the public can be better informed on decisions of the court by using AI to generate audio of written opinions. The case before us today is Fernandez v. United States, docket number 24556, decided May 28, 26. Before reading the opinion itself, here is a brief summary of the case and the questions presented. Joe Fernandez was convicted of murder for hire and a firearms offense for his role in the assassination of two gang members, and the district court imposed two consecutive life sentences. After the Second Circuit affirmed his conviction on direct appeal, and after he twice unsuccessfully sought post-conviction relief under 28 United States Code, Section 2255, Fernandez filed a motion for compassionate release under 18 United States Code, Section 3582, arguing that extraordinary and compelling reasons, above all his claim of innocence, warranted a reduced sentence. The district court granted the motion based on doubts about the soundness of the conviction, but the Second Circuit reversed, holding that challenges to the validity of a conviction are not cognizable as extraordinary and compelling reasons under the compassionate release statute. The question presented was whether a combination of extraordinary and compelling reasons that may warrant a discretionary sentence reduction under 18 United States Code, Section 3582C, can include reasons that may also be alleged as grounds for vacatur of a sentence under 28 United States Code, Section 2255. The court held, a prisoner who collaterally attacks the validity of his conviction must proceed through 28 United States Code, Section 2255, not 18 United States Code, Section 3582. The supposed invalidity of a conviction is not among the extraordinary and compelling reasons that justify compassionate release. Justice Barrett delivered the opinion of the court, in which Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh joined. Justice Sotomayor filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, in which Justice Kagan joined. Justice Jackson filed a dissenting opinion. As a reminder, the audio is an AI-generated reading of a published opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. The voice you will hear has been synthesized to loosely resemble that of the justice that wrote the opinion. All tone, inflection, pacing, and emphasis are produced by the AI model and should not be attributed to any justice. The text itself has been lightly adapted to aid in the creation of the spoken delivery. This is a project to attempt to make court decisions more accessible to the public, and any substantive changes during the reading are completely unintentional. Please visit www.supremecourt.gov to read the opinion published by the court. You can find a link directly to the opinion in this episode's description. As the audio is AI generated, you may hear some audio glitches, including odd pronunciation, noticeable pauses, or repeated words. We're continually working to improve our process to reduce these, and we appreciate you sticking with us as we improve the listening experience. The following is the opinion of the court in Fernandez v. United States.
A federal statute authorizes district courts to shorten prison sentences for extraordinary and compelling reasons, most commonly, conditions like the prisoner's age and infirmity. United States Code, Section 3582C. Petitioner Joe Fernandez argues that doubts about a conviction's validity also qualify as extraordinary and compelling reasons for relief under the statute. We disagree. A prisoner who collaterally attacks the validity of his conviction must proceed through United States Code, Section 2255, not United States Code, Section 3582. Fernandez was indicted in 2013 for his role in the assassination of two gang members. The prosecution's theory was that members of a drug ring had paid Fernandez $40,000 to act as the backup shooter. When the primary shooter's gun jammed, Fernandez stepped in. He fired 14 rounds, killing both victims. Fernandez's cousin, an alleged co-conspirator, Patrick Darge, testified against him at trial. To discredit Darge, Fernandez's counsel argued that Darge was framing Fernandez to protect the real second shooter, Darge's brother. Unconvinced, the jury convicted Fernandez of murder for hire and a firearms offense. See 18 United States Code, Sections 9024J, 1958. The district court then imposed two consecutive life sentences. Fernandez asked the district court to reconsider, alleging that the prosecution had violated Brady v. Maryland, decided in 1963. He pressed that argument several times, first in a motion to vacate the verdict, then in a motion for new trial, and again in a motion for rehearing. According to Fernandez, the government should have disclosed that another alleged co-conspirator, Luis Rivera, had denied driving the getaway car. To determine whether Rivera had in fact denied his involvement, the district court reviewed the government's notes from Rivera's interview. It concluded that they did not contain any relevant information. There was no evidence that Rivera had ever made such a statement, and it was not clear that it would have mattered to the jury if he had. Even so, the judge noted that he was troubled that prosecutors had allowed Rivera to plead to a lesser narcotics offense and had dismissed the murder and gun charges against him. In the judge's view, the prosecutors could have used the evidence in Fernandez's case to show that Rivera had engaged in similar wrongdoing. Fernandez appealed, and the Second Circuit affirmed his conviction and sentence. Although Fernandez argued that the government had failed to turn over its notes before trial, those notes did not reflect Rivera's unequivocal denial of a getaway driver role. In any event, the court said, Fernandez fails to show how the notes could have been useful for impeaching any witness. Fernandez also argued that insufficient evidence supported his conviction. He insisted that Darge's testimony was not credible and highlighted the government's choice not to charge Rivera as a co-conspirator in the murder-for-hire plot, which he considered indicative of the weakness of the government's case. But the court rejected the insufficiency claim too. It held that a reasonable jury could credit Darge's testimony, that it was corroborated by other evidence in the record, and that the evidence was sufficient to support Fernandez's conviction. Fernandez persisted. He twice moved for post-conviction relief under 28 United States Code, Section 2255. The first time, Fernandez argued, among other things, that he was actually innocent because the testimony against him was not credible. He said that even the government did not fully believe Patrick Darge, as shown by the government's decision not to charge Rivera with murder for hire. The Second Circuit described this argument as plainly meritless, concluding that the jury was entitled to credit the witnesses who testified that Fernandez committed the crimes with which he was charged. The second collateral challenge succeeded. The district court set aside Fernandez's conviction for a firearms offense after United States v. Davis, decided in 2019, held that 18 United States Code, Section 924C's residual clause, is unconstitutionally vague. Still, the district judge remained troubled about Fernandez's murder-for-hire conviction. No new evidence had surfaced. But the judge continued to focus on Rivera, the getaway driver who had pleaded guilty to a less serious charge. In his order vacating the firearms conviction, the judge speculated that the government had offered Rivera such a lenient plea deal because it knew something inconsistent with Darge's testimony. And if Darge was lying, the judge wondered, perhaps there is something to petitioner's argument that not he, but Patrick Darge's brother was the second shooter, and that Patrick Darge testified to cover that up. Notably, the Second Circuit had already rejected this argument twice, and Fernandez had not briefed it again before the district court. But the judge brought it up anyway, pointedly noting that if Fernandez's life sentence on the murder-for-hire charge were to be commuted or held unlawful, Fernandez would be released immediately. Fernandez took the hint. Within 2 weeks, he filed a motion for compassionate release under Section 3582C. He argued that extraordinary and compelling reasons, above all that he was innocent, warranted a sentencing reduction. According to Fernandez, Darge's testimony was biased and uncorroborated by forensic evidence. Moreover, his identification of Rivera as the getaway driver was inconsistent with a later statement made by Rivera himself. The government had not turned over its notes on that statement, Fernandez asserted, and had allowed Rivera to plead guilty to a lesser charge. The district court granted the motion. Nearly a decade after presiding over the trial and sentencing, the judge felt a certain disquiet about whether Darge's testimony had been truthful and whether the cross-examination had been effective. He had strong concerns about the government's decision to charge the getaway driver with a lesser offense and doubted that the jury's verdict was correct. Darge might have sacrificed Fernandez to save his brother, and Fernandez might not have been the shooter or even a member of the conspiracy. That disquiet formed the basis of the district court's finding that petitioner Joe Fernandez has shown extraordinary and compelling circumstances for his release. The Second Circuit reversed, holding that challenges to the validity of a conviction are not cognizable as extraordinary and compelling reasons under Section 3582. Congress has channeled such claims into federal post-conviction proceedings under 28 United States Code, Section 2255, and by design, compassionate release and Section 2255 do not overlap. Challenging the validity of a conviction under the extraordinary and compelling reasons prong of Section 3582, the court explained, would permit a defendant to evade the collateral review structures of Section 2255. While seven other circuits have reached the same conclusion, two have taken the other side. We granted certiorari to resolve the split. Collateral attacks on federal convictions are governed by 28 United States Code, Section 2255, which imposes tight procedural constraints. It carries a one-year statute of limitations. With very narrow exceptions, a prisoner gets only one shot at collateral relief. Claims that have already been raised and rejected on direct review typically cannot be relitigated in Section 2255 motions. And claims not raised on direct review are procedurally defaulted unless the prisoner can demonstrate cause and prejudice, or else actual innocence. If the prisoner clears these procedural hurdles, he must demonstrate that the applicable substantive law entitles him to relief. Section 2255's companion statute, 28 United States Code, Section 2254, imposes similar constraints on state prisoners. Recall that Fernandez brought and lost a challenge to his conviction under Section 2255. This case arises from his motion presenting similar arguments under a different statute, 18 United States Code, Section 3582, which permits prisoners to seek compassionate release from prison. In contrast to Section 2255's reticulated scheme, Section 3582 imposes a single procedural requirement. A prisoner must first present his request for release to the Bureau of Prisons. A motion may then be filed in district court, where the prisoner or the Bureau, acting on his behalf, must show that extraordinary and compelling reasons warrant his early release from confinement. This is not the first time we have addressed the relationship between the habeas statutes and other kinds of prisoner litigation. In Prisor v. Rodriguez, prisoners brought claims under 42 United States Code, Section 1983, challenging the forfeiture of their good time credits, and their claims plainly came within the literal terms of that statute. Even so, we held that the broad language of Section 1983 did not afford the prisoners a cause of action. Congress has determined that habeas corpus is the appropriate remedy for state prisoners attacking the validity of the fact or length of their confinement, and that specific determination must override the general terms of Section 1983. Challenges close to the core of habeas corpus must be brought, if at all, under the specific federal habeas corpus statute, in that case Section 2254, which was explicitly and historically designed to provide the means for a state prisoner to attack the validity of his confinement. A contrary result would allow prisoners to evade Section 2254's requirements, and so would wholly frustrate explicit congressional intent. That is why Section 1983 must be read in harmony with the habeas statute. Gonzalez v. Crosby, decided in 2005, flows in the same vein. There, we held that prisoners may not use Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 60B to argue that a denial of habeas relief was wrong on the merits and warrants reopening. The language of Rule 60B is expansive, permitting courts to reopen a final judgment whenever a movant shows any reason that justifies relief. And the text of Section 2254 did not expressly circumscribe the operation of Rule 60B. Yet allowing movants to use a Rule 60B motion to make merits arguments would still collide with Section 2254. It would permit movants to circumvent the strict statutory habeas standards, including that a successive habeas petition be precertified by the Court of Appeals. And the rule could not be applied to habeas proceedings in a manner inconsistent with Section 2254. Thus, Rule 60B's allowance of reopening for any reason was narrowed to account for Section 2254. Much like the prisoners in Prizer and Gonzalez, Fernandez has pursued a collateral attack outside the rigorous habeas framework. And as in those cases, the workaround is impermissible. Challenging the validity of a conviction through a compassionate release motion circumvents the exacting requirements of Section 2255. Indeed, Fernandez candidly admits that avoiding Section 2255's procedural and substantive requirements is the benefit of his approach. As for procedure, Fernandez asserted at oral argument that there are harsh limitations associated with Section 2255, and Congress has stated that those limitations are appropriate, but it doesn't mean that in every case, as applied to every defendant, that those limitations are fair. According to Fernandez, the ability to bring a merits-based challenge under Section 3582 mitigates the error and the unfairness of the prisoners not having been able to bring it under Section 2255. His take on substance is similar. He offers the example of a prisoner who claims that prosecutors withheld mitigating evidence and that his lawyer was constitutionally ineffective for failing to pursue that evidence. Fernandez posits that these arguments would fail to satisfy the legal intricacies of the doctrines related to Brady v. Maryland and Strickland v. Washington. Still, Fernandez asserts, these half-baked legal challenges could count as extraordinary and compelling reasons that justify a reduced sentence. The dissent, too, proclaims that the core mission of compassionate release is to offer deserving prisoners relief from the rigors of Section 2255. It is easy to see why Fernandez would prefer this construction. Section 3582, in sharp contrast to Section 2255, imposes no time limit or numerical cap on motions, nor is there any bar to raising issues waived or already decided on direct appeal. So, a prisoner proceeding under Section 3582 could challenge the validity of his conviction repeatedly, for years after it became final, even if the issue had already been raised or decided in prior proceedings. This system would enable prisoners not only to bypass Section 2255, but also to override it. Consider this very case. Fernandez lost an argument on direct review and under Section 2255, but then repackaged it in a motion under Section 3582C and obtained release from prison on those twice rejected grounds. We will not set Section 3582 and Section 2255 at cross purposes when we can construe them in harmony. Congress made compassionate release available only when extraordinary and compelling reasons justify it. Section 3582C. That is a demanding standard. And, as we did with Section 1983 in Prizer and Rule 60B in Gonzalez, we interpret Section 3582 against the backdrop of the detailed process that Congress explicitly and historically designed for attacking the validity of a prisoner's confinement. Seen in that light, the supposed invalidity of a conviction is not among the extraordinary and compelling reasons that justify compassionate release. While Congress has not defined the extraordinary and compelling reasons that may warrant a reduced sentence, these criteria are not empty vessels. Extraordinary means most unusual, far from common, and having little or no precedent. Webster's Third New International Dictionary, 807, 1976. Also, Oxford English Dictionary, 614 Second Edition, 1989, out of the usual or regular course or order. Compelling means tending to convince or convert by, or as if by, forcefulness of evidence. Webster's Third New International Dictionary. Also, Oxford English Dictionary, irresistible, demanding attention, respect. We will focus on the latter requirement. An argument that is compelling in one context is not necessarily so in another. The force of an argument depends on what it seeks to justify. For instance, a 25th wedding anniversary is a convincing reason to shorten a business trip, but it is not a convincing reason to shorten a prison sentence. So here, we do not ask in the abstract whether a challenge to the validity of a conviction is compelling. We ask whether it is an especially convincing reason to grant the relief sought, compassionate release from prison. Section 2255's reticulated scheme bears on this inquiry. A reason is not compelling if Congress has channeled it through the post-conviction statutes. Even Fernandez recognizes that an argument may be less compelling if it could have been, and was not, asserted through Section 2255. He admits that courts may consider, as part of the extraordinary and compelling analysis, whether a defendant sat on his rights or whether he's taken all opportunities to enforce his rights. Yet the same is true for Section 2255's other substantive and procedural requirements, that Congress has chosen to make Section 2255 a high bar is not a compelling reason to reduce the sentences of prisoners who fall short. Other features of the statute point in the same direction. The name for Section 3582C, Compassionate Release, highlights its focus on granting mercy rather than righting legal wrongs. In keeping with the theme of compassion, Congress in Section 3582 gives special protection to defendants with a terminal illness. For instance, the director of the Bureau of Prisons must notify terminally ill prisoners of their right to seek compassionate release, must sometimes assist in preparing those compassionate release requests, and must report to Congress the number of prisoners who died while their request was pending. In addition, the statute expressly identifies one situation in which a sentencing reduction is warranted when the defendant is at least 70 years of age, has served at least 30 years of a certain type of mandatory life sentence, and the director of the Bureau of Prisons determines that the defendant is not a danger to the safety of any other person or the community. And in another statute that references Section 3582C, Congress has permitted the Sentencing Commission to treat a defendant's rehabilitation as a relevant consideration in granting compassionate release. The role of the Bureau of Prisons reflects the statute's focus on a defendant's personal circumstances, his advanced age, safety risk, illness, rehabilitation, and the like. The Bureau evaluates compassionate release motions in the first instance. Until 2018, a district court could reduce a sentence only upon motion of the director of the Bureau of Prisons. After the First Step Act, prisoners may file their own compassionate release motions, but only if the Bureau declines or fails to respond to a prisoner's request that the director file on his behalf. Fernandez agrees that this procedural shift in the Bureau's role from exclusive filer to initial evaluator did not change the substantive standard applicable to compassionate release motions. If compassionate release were a vehicle for attacking the validity of a conviction, it is hard to see why the Bureau of Prisons would run the process. The Bureau's institutional expertise lies in the daily lives of prisoners, matters relating to their safekeeping, care, subsistence, protection, instruction, and discipline. So it makes sense for the statute to instruct the Bureau to help terminally ill prisoners seek compassionate release. By contrast, it makes little sense to have the Bureau evaluate legal arguments and comb trial records to determine whether a prisoner has a compelling argument that his conviction was wrongful. Even Fernandez concedes that analyzing potential trial errors is outside the Bureau's bailiwick. Take Fernandez's own situation. How would the Bureau determine whether the testimony at his trial was credible? Or take Fernandez's hypothetical. How would the Bureau evaluate arguments raised under Brady v. Maryland and Strickland v. Washington? Congress's decision to route compassionate release motions through the Bureau strongly suggests that the extraordinary and compelling reasons warranting compassionate release must be reasons that the director is competent to assess. Regulatory history points the same way. Congress has authorized the Sentencing Commission to issue policy statements about when compassionate release is warranted, and these policy statements shape whether courts may grant compassionate release motions. For decades, the Sentencing Commission has tied the availability of compassionate release to a defendant's personal circumstances. See United States Sentencing Commission Guidelines, Manual Appendix C, 2007. Listing extraordinary and compelling reasons to include terminal illness, a permanent physical or medical condition, the death or incapacitation of the defendant's only family members capable of caring for the defendant's minor child, or other reasons as determined by the director of the Bureau of Prisons. While the Sentencing Commission has issued more detailed policy statements over the years, it has maintained the same basic categories. it has never said that the invalidity of a conviction qualifies as an extraordinary and compelling reason warranting compassionate release. In short, the structural inference of Prizer and Gonzalez is borne out in Section 3582 itself. The Heartland extraordinary and compelling reasons that might warrant an early release from prison, including age, illness, and a child left with no guardian, bear no resemblance to the grounds for relief under Section 2255. Fernandez cannot deploy Section 3582 to blunt what he perceives to be the sharp edges of Section 2255. Fernandez insists that because Section 2255 and Section 3582 offer different forms of relief, the structural inference from Prizer and Gonzalez does not apply. Under Section 2255, a court could set aside Fernandez's conviction as if it never happened. But Fernandez is not going for that, at least not in this round. Now, he seeks the more modest relief permitted by Section 3582, a reduced sentence. If he succeeds, he would leave prison early, but his murder-for-hire conviction, along with its collateral effects, would remain in place. That distinction, he says, means that he is not circumventing Section 2255, but rather proceeding on an entirely different track. Instead of helping him, this argument highlights the mismatch between the error Fernandez alleges and the remedy he seeks. When an elderly or infirm prisoner is discharged early, the reasons for release have nothing to do with the lawfulness of the conviction, so it makes sense to leave it in place. But when a prisoner persuades a court that his conviction is invalid, the remedy of a little less prison time does not redress the wrong. If a conviction is invalid, the fitting remedy is to vacate it, as Section 2255 allows. That Section 3582 does not offer. This remedy is evidence that it is not a suitable vehicle for the claim. In any event, the difference in relief does not render Prizer irrelevant. The remedies were not identical in Prizer either. The prisoner sought an injunction under Section 1983 for the restoration of good time credits, rather than habeas relief. This formal distinction did not change our analysis. What mattered was that Prizer brought a claim close to the core of habeas corpus. When, as here, a prisoner attacks the validity of his confinement and seeks either immediate release from that confinement or the shortening of its duration, his claim belongs under the umbrella of the post-conviction statutes. And to be clear, Fernandez is challenging the validity of his conviction, even though he is not asking to have it vacated or set aside. Whether a prisoner's request for relief challenges a conviction turns on the nature of the arguments presented. See, for example, Gonzalez, holding that only some arguments presented in a Rule 60B motion would improperly infringe on Section 2254. When a prisoner moves for compassionate release based on a terminal illness, his motion does not suggest that his conviction is invalid. But if a prisoner moves for relief because of alleged problems with the underlying criminal investigation or trial, his motion suggests that his conviction is flawed. That is true here. Fernandez's motion said he would never commit murder for hire, questioned whether the district judge would have reached the same verdict as the jury, urged the court not to credit Darge's testimony, alleged that the government failed to turn over or present to the jury highly exculpatory notes from interviewing Rivera, and even argued that Fernandez could sufficiently show his actual innocence to satisfy Schlup v. Dello, decided in 1995, which governs certain procedurally defaulted habeas claims. The district court then impermissibly treated Fernandez's challenge to his conviction as an extraordinary and compelling reason for sentencing reduction. It expressed reason to question the verdict, doubt that the jury's verdict was correct, and the belief that the prosecution distrusted the testimony of its star witness. In other words, the district court harbored doubts about the soundness of the conviction. Fernandez offers a backup position, even if Section 3582C does not ordinarily allow district courts to grant compassionate release, for reasons that would support a Section 2255 motion, he asserts that actual innocence claims are an exception. He points out that a factual showing of actual innocence has never been held to state a ground for federal habeas relief absent an independent constitutional violation. Thus, he says, such a claim must be cognizable under Section 3582. Otherwise, a prisoner might have nowhere to go. It bears emphasis that this argument is only marginally relevant to Fernandez himself. No court, not even the district court that reduced his sentence, concluded that Fernandez was actually innocent. His evidentiary challenges were repeatedly rejected, and the district court reduced his sentence because of disquiet about the conviction, not confidence in Fernandez's innocence. So, even if an actual innocence claim were cognizable under Section 3582, Fernandez would not benefit from it. In any event, this case gives us no occasion to decide the antecedent question whether a prisoner may assert a freestanding actual innocence claim under Section 2255. We have never ruled that possibility out and do not do so now. Instead, we hold simply that a compassionate release motion is not a vehicle for raising such a claim. A prisoner asserting actual innocence challenges the validity of his conviction, whether factually or legally, and that lies close to the core of habeas corpus. If it is not in substance a habeas corpus application, it is at least similar enough that failing to subject it to the same requirements would forge a path for bypassing the post-conviction statutes. And for the reasons we have already stated, Section 3582 does not provide that kind of shortcut. Fernandez's remaining arguments echo those presented in another case, which we also decide today. See Rutherford v. United States, 2026. Petitioners in both cases contend that the phrase extraordinary and compelling reasons vests courts with broad discretion to grant a prisoner compassionate release for virtually any reason whatsoever. We reject these arguments here for the same reasons we reject them in Rutherford. While the terms extraordinary and compelling leave room for judgment, they are not so flexible as to encompass any consideration. The compassionate release provision is not a vehicle for attacking the validity of a conviction. Accordingly, the judgment of the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit is affirmed. It is so ordered.